Sunday evening edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, 15 and 60 on the Eastern Conference. We're going to go through in alphabetical order, starting with the Hawks, ending with the Wizards. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone about the Twitter NBA show. Twitter asked Danny and I to come in and do a live streaming show at halftime of both of the national games on Wednesday, and then we're also going to be doing a post-game show as well. This hopefully is going to become a regular thing, assuming that the demand is out there for it. So please tune into that. You can follow me on Periscope at NateDuncanNBA. And we'll also be tweeting the link out live, so you can just watch it live within Twitter if you want to also. So that'll be on Wednesday at halftime of the Golden State Raptors game. It'll be the first one, and then it's Memphis Clippers. After that, we'll do a halftime show followed by a post-game show, taking people's questions, reacting to the game, looking forward to the second half for the halftime shows. It's going to be a ton of fun, and Danny and I are really excited about it. We are sponsored today by Hint Water. drinkhint.com/capspace is how you can get started with them. And then of course our friends at SeatGeek, using that capspace code, you can get a $20 rebate after making your first SeatGeek purchase. Let's get to statistically the second best team in basketball right now, the Atlanta Hawks.
And I think the place that you have to start with the Hawks is with Dwight Howard, because Dwight Howard, not only has he been really good, but he has also changed the way that the Hawks succeed, which is impressive when you have a team that was really good last year and is so good again this year.
Yeah. And I think the fact that they have changed up has really been a credit to Coach Bud. They're 7-2, by the way. Howard has just transformed the rebounding. I think the Hawks, to my recollection, were actually the worst team in NBA history on the offensive glass last year. And now when he's on the floor, they're getting 29% of offensive rebounds. That's near the top of the league. And 79% of defensive rebounds when he's on the floor. And when they played Cleveland the other day, Cleveland used to kill them on the offensive glass. No longer when Howard is out there. And he's just been pretty much fantastic. 24 PER, 600 true shooting percentage. His usage is back up to about 23%. It had gotten below 20%, below average for the first time in his career in Houston. And he's averaging 4.9 offensive rebounds a game in only 28 minutes a game, which is absolutely ridiculous.
It is. And that kind of through line of guys getting back to their kind of prior standard is also applicable to Kyle Korver. Korver last year struggled a little bit shooting the ball, and there was this open question about whether he would be able to get, whether that was the new normal or whether he would get back. And at the moment, he's shooting 47% on threes. So at least for right now, it seems like that was the aberration, not this.
Yeah. And of course, he had that ankle injury, so he wasn't able to train. He famously is extremely regimented when it comes to his offseason training. The two guys that maybe give me a little bit of pause for this team right now, Schroeder still turning the ball over a ton. They are really down at the bottom of the league in terms of percentage of time that they turn the ball over. And Schroeder shooting 35% on threes, which is good, but really, really poorly on long twos, which again, one of the big bugaboos for the Hawks is when you switch defensively on them, can their guards make a play? Now, if you have Howard, maybe the thought is that teams will be loath to switch on Howard. I wouldn't be yet, because Howard still, his post-ups have been okay, but nothing special still. And he has been going to those a little bit more than he was in Houston, and he's been reasonably successful. It hasn't been awful the way it has been at times in the last few years. And then the other thing too is that Paul Millsap's efficiency is down a little bit. He, as expected, is getting less shots at the rim than he did last year, because he's now playing with Dwight Howard, and Dwight Howard takes up space down there. You don't have the spacing. They pretty much had two bigs who could shoot in at all times last year, and Millsap was able to either drive or post up, although he still is one of the best in the league at his transition post-ups. Like, if you watch him when he closes out on a shooter at the top of the key, he will just run down and post up right under the basket, and it's like a foul or a layup every time.
And that's also something that, while having Dwight complicates the spacing in the half court, it creates more transition opportunities, because they're a lot more solid on defense rebounding than they were. So you can do that without feeling like you're imperiling your team on the defensive glass. And so that it is opening up a little bit of that for Millsap. But the other thing I wanted to talk about with them is their bench. Their bench has been excellent so far this year, and you can think about that as a collective, but also as individuals. Malcolm Delaney's done well. Tabo Sefolosha's done really well. Mike Muscala's done well. And so it is kind of a hallmark of the Hawks of trying to get guys through. And from what I've seen, they haven't gotten a ton from the rookies yet. So that's even more encouraging that they're getting it from more established players that they have on their roster.
Yeah, we've talked about, and we will talk about, all these teams who are getting killed when they go to their bench. And the Hawks are one of the teams that are basically doing the killing. Now, Sefolosha he can't continue to shoot this well. He's shooting 83% on long twos, and he's been fantastic at the rim as well. You know, he's 32, like it's not going to necessarily continue. And one interesting thing to watch is they have by far their lowest net rating among rotation guys with Dennis Schroeder on the floor. It's only 1.5, whereas with Delaney, they're 26.8. Now, Delaney hasn't been great in terms of his individual statistics. Schroeder's looked better there, but something to watch where maybe Delaney will end up closing some games here if they continue to play so much better with him on the floor. And Schroeder continuing a pattern where the Hawks have been much worse with him on the floor, despite the fact that he has had pretty good individual statistics over the years. Anything else on them, or should we move on to the Celtics?
I think we should probably move on. As good as the Hawks have played, we will have more time to talk about them in the future.
Yeah, we are going to do an episode on assessing how the surprise teams are doing, whether they can continue that. And I think that the Hawks will feature prominently in that, as will many of these teams. So you'll see we're not going to talk that much about, oh, is this start sustainable for teams and players? We'll get to that hopefully later in the week. But before we move on to Boston, let's talk about Hint Water. Drinking water, we know it's good for you. Personally, when I'm dehydrated, I am just a much worse person. I'm prone to get headaches. My workouts are terrible. But the problem is that drinking water is really kind of difficult. And then a lot of sports drinks have calories. Juices have calories. So Hint Water makes drinking water much, much more palatable. It's a flavored water that's not going to overwhelm you. They have flavors to suit any palate. My girlfriend really liked the watermelon. I prefer blackberry. There's no sugar, no chemicals, just natural fruit-flavored water. And both Health and Self magazines have named Hint Water the best flavored water. And by ordering it, you don't have to carry heavy cases of water back from the store. You just have it delivered right to your doorstep. So you can get started with them with a single variety pack shipped directly to your door. That includes 3 bottles each of Hint's 4 most popular flavors, pineapple, watermelon, crisp apple, and blackberry. I was also a fan of the crisp apple as well. That's normally $24, but it's only $15 when you go to drinkhint.com/capspace. Capspace is easy to remember. We talk about it all the time on the program. Drinkhint.com/capspace gets you that discount. Also lets them know that you came from us, which of course is important for tracking purposes. Drinkhint.com/capspace. I thought that these last 2 wins for Boston were pretty important because they've really had struggled with Crowder out and with Horford out. And Crowder looks like he's going to come back on Wednesday. It's a little troubling that Horford has missed almost 2 weeks now with this concussion. That is does not sound like it was a mild concussion at all. But, you know, to get back over 500 now without 2 of their 3 best players for most of the season, I think that's pretty good. They are not, you know, now they're only a couple of games behind, like, say, Toronto. And so if they can get back and get healthy, this stretch won't have been fatal to their chances of maybe getting the number 2 seed.
Yeah, there are a couple of different takeaways from that. One is, you know, that they do need those players to be at their best. That's not a surprise at all. And we'll get into one of the reasons why. But something else that I like sometimes about a team that is survives a stretch with injuries early on, Utah could be another one like this, is that they build some confidence in their lower level guys. And so, you know, players that are in the rotation but have had an outsized role. And while he doesn't completely fit this perfectly, I think Marcus Smart, since he's gotten back, has done a nice job.
Yeah, he, of course, missed some time with this sprained ankle as well. It took some time to get up to speed. And he's actually starting to provide now some of the playmaking that people thought he was going to provide coming out of Oklahoma State. He was supposed to be this team's just starting point guard of the future. Remember, this was before they had acquired Isaiah Thomas. And he has had these ankle injuries at the start of each year. At least this one was a little milder, so it seems like he's back to himself. And he had 10 assists the other night. He's at a 21% usage, and 50% true shooting isn't amazing, but it's at least acceptable and far better than he's been so far in his career. He's shooting 36% on threes, not a ton of threes, obviously, in a sample so far, but that's pretty good. 42% at the rim is not very good, of course, but his pick and roll playmaking has really been solid. He's in above the 90th percentile in pick and roll offense when you also throw in the result of the passes that he's had. Again, some luck involved there. This is only, we're talking about 35 possessions here, but on either his own offense or on passes out of the pick and roll, 43 points on those 35 possessions for the Celtics so far. So that's him being able to come in and take over a little bit of Evan Turner's role, playmaking on the second unit. Avery Bradley also has done the same thing. He's increased his usage and has shot it pretty well. He's been getting to the basket a little bit more, and all that's been good. And I don't really make too much of the fact that their defense has been terrible so far, just because with Crowder and Horford are probably, I think, think they're two best defensive players, or maybe if not two best, two most important.
Yeah, and some of that also relates to the idea of replacements. So, you know, Jaylen Brown has played a lot in place of Crowder and Well. I think we both feel that he will be a solid to maybe even much better than solid defender later on. He's a rookie. That's really hard to do. And then Tyler Zeller, who is the guy I was alluding to before, has struggled a lot, but at full strength, Tyler Zeller is not going to be a significant part of the Celtics team.
Yeah, he'll be their fifth big, and it's really remarkable how bad they are on defense when he's in. And this has been an issue for them overall, not having any bigs who play with force. Amir Johnson is starting to wind down a little bit. Athletically, he's not really as much of a shot blocking force as he was, but Zeller in particular, just on the defensive glass, protecting the rim, moving his feet in transition or in pick and roll defense, he really is just a big liability, despite the fact that he can get open sometimes. Like in that Pacers game, he was able to find space against Al Jefferson for his mid-ranger, and but he just like you would be hard pressed to find anything where you're like, oh, that was a strong play in watching him over the course of an entire game, whether on offense or defense. He kind of goes up soft on both ends.
Yeah, it's a challenge, and reducing his role. I mean, Kelly Olynyk's still out as well. Like getting
no, Kelly's back.
That's actually been a
huge part of why they've turned it around a little bit now, because Zeller is able to. He and Amir Johnson are starting. That was the front court combo that I liked a lot for them last year. They went to it in the middle of the year, and then just for whatever reason didn't play very well for four or five games, and then they went away from it. Started Sullinger again, and then of course Olynyk basically didn't play at all in that playoff series against the Hawks. So I think having him back is definitely useful, and he is an underrated defense player. Again, not a guy who plays a ton of force, but then able to space out to three and punish plays on or punish switches in the post. All that, I think he's a pretty valuable player for them. So that big rotation of Johnson, Horford, Olynyk, and Jonas Jerebko, who's shot pretty poorly so far, but I think he'll come around there. He's shot it well the last few years, is big. But I think the other thing we're missing too, because their defense has been really bad, is that the offense has been excellent, and Isaiah Thomas somehow has gotten even better than he was last year.
Yeah, I mean, he's averaging 26 points a game, which is incredible when you think about all of his other responsibilities, and he's doing it efficiently.
Yeah, 62% true shooting for Thomas. And so, yeah, he's been really one of their better players, or one of the better players in the Eastern Conference, I should say. Sorry, I got a little distracted because the cat jumped up in front of the monitor there. One thing, too, is I think they really are positioned now to go on a run, because in their next 11 games, they are going to be favored in all but two of them, probably. And both of those are at home, even the Warriors and Spurs. They should, I think, be fit. You see any other ones on there that they wouldn't be favored in?
No,
assuming
they're full strength, they should be fine. I mean, they're also facing a couple of teams as they're coming back from injuries, so they get to face the Mavericks. Dirk, we still don't know, he's questionable against the Knicks, so we still don't know then against the next game, which is that one. Pelicans, just all these teams that are kind of grappling with some more complicated stuff. And so, yeah, they have the chance to do that. And I mean, there are other teams, including the Hawks, who we just mentioned, who are having a strong start, but the Celtics shouldn't be too inconvenienced as long as they can stay normally healthy moving forward.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they go 8-3, 9-2 or so over these next games, assuming that they are healthy. Let's get to a team that might actually qualify as one of the biggest surprises for me, and we'll talk about that more on that episode as well. The Brooklyn Nets, now 4-5 after a very nice win in Phoenix, who had just beaten Detroit a couple nights before that.
Well, I liked a tweet that you put out, I think it was yesterday, about the idea that maybe it's also us being on the West Coast, but Luke Walton's gotten a lot of buzz, a lot of shine for the very good job that he's done changing around the Lakers. And Kenny Atkinson is doing that in Brooklyn. And I think I would argue, especially considering the kind of nature of the talent, that he's doing it with a higher degree of difficulty.
Well, especially when you consider that they've actually now, I think they're 2-2 since Lynn and Vasquez went out. We didn't talk about this, but Vasquez needs another surgery on that ankle after re-injury. It and he actually got released despite $4 million guaranteed. So they and Lynn still doesn't have a timetable yet with his hamstring. He's not even scheduled to be reevaluated, I think, until the end of this week. So really remarkable what they've been able to do offensively. And the key really has been they're just taking great shots. They're taking only 9.1 shots from mid-range per game. That is second lowest in the league behind Houston. And then Denver is the next lowest at 14. So you can tell this is clearly a philosophical approach from Atkinson. And you noted too that they're getting a ton of spot-up jumpers.
They are. So one of the things that I'm liking to look at, and this is in the free part of Synergy that's on the NBA stats site, is not necessarily how a team succeeds in a given area, but the frequency. So they are shooting the highest proportion of their shots as spot-ups, as classified by Synergy. And that's a really good sign, because those are not the best shots, but they're on the higher end.
That's a great point. And they have Brook Lopez, but Brook's only been playing about 27 minutes a game. They don't really have anyone who can do anything off the bounce and really get to the rim and finish. But it just shows, especially during the regular season, what you can do by just having good shooting on the floor and a good system. Just having guys like Harris, Boyan out there, Sean Kilpatrick, Justin Hamilton has been a revelation. We really liked that signing. KP kind of turned us on to what he'd been doing in the ACB league last year, and Hamilton has been playing mostly at the four, but he has definitely played a lot of these traditional bigs off the floor just due to his shooting ability. I mean, he had one game where he was 5 out of 5 on three pointers last week. One disappointment though has been Rondae Hollis-Jefferson's offense. He is shooting 4 of 17 at the rim so far this season, and about the same number of shots from 3 to 10 feet. He's shooting 33% on those. He has been successful actually getting to the basket at times. And one of the things that Atkinson, as part of this Atlanta, Utah coaching tree, has brought over is this idea of really starting your drive before you catch the pass. And they've got him doing that. He's able to actually get by guys at times and get into the rim, but then he just cannot finish over any type of a contest at all. He only has one dunk out of those 17 shots. And he probably had like 5 or 6 of those plays where if he had just been able to go up with his right hand for a normal right hand layup, he would have been able to finish it, but he had to bring it back to the defense with his left. A couple of times he did try it with his right hand. I appreciate trying it, but he was just way off. I mean, he's had maybe half of these shots like haven't even hit the rim. Like he just gets bumped, like shoots it over the rim, just hits the backboard. He is not really able to get great extension. He has two hands on the ball a lot too, which for a guy with his length is a little bit disappointing. Not really able to get a ton of explosion when he has a body on him either. And also notable is that pretty much all of these shots are plays that are off his own drives, as opposed to really getting cuts or even getting out in transition. I think only one or two of these layups was in transition. He's actually shooting it okay from mid-range, not at all from three, of course, but I think his mid-range jumper is going to get to passable. And when they play with more shooting at the four too, with Hamilton, I think they can get by with him not being as much of a shooter, but he's just got to finish a little bit better. Like if you're going to be a player like that, you have to at least finish your shots at the rim and be a threat there and find more avenues to cut as well.
With a player who is defense first and who provides a lot of value in that end, they have to reach kind of a threshold minimum in terms of offensive capability. And you can do that in a lot of different ways. I mean, Tony Allen was one of the league's best cutters for a long time. You can do it that way. You can get to the foul line as long as you can make some of them. And Hollis Jefferson just has to find that point. But something else I want to mention, I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit later, but I just have to make sure that it's out there that before this season, Brook Lopez is high in terms of 3-point attempts per game. His high average was last season at 0.2. This year, he is averaging 4.8 per game. That is incredible.
He's shooting them easy.
Yeah, and I think that there is this kind of trend of guys just that, you know, Lopez always had some range on his jumper. I was impressed with it at Stanford, but he never pushed it out this far. And kudos to all the coaches that are basically just saying, take another step or two back. Marc Gasol's had a couple of games like that, because it really does open things up. And of course, it's worth more points.
Let's move on to Charlotte now. A positive surprise. 6-2. They did lose at home to the Raptors, but no MKG. Had some back spasms. He is questionable for tonight's or today's game against Cleveland, which actually I should know the answer to that. It's because it's just about to start, but I'm not going to break off from this podcast to go look up whether he's playing against Cleveland or not. And if he doesn't play, I assume they're probably going to get killed, because they got killed by DeRozan. Without him, they had to start Travion Graham, who wasn't able to really stop DeRozan and doesn't provide much of a threat on offense either. But the big story with Charlotte, other than their typically unbelievable defense, which big surprise that that's happening, even though Roy Hibbert has barely played due to a knee issue and Cody Zeller has been limited. They just get every defensive rebound and control transition, and they're just really good defensively. Kemba Walker on offense has been fantastic. And the biggest difference for him, we talked about how he became a better finisher at the rim last year due to them having more spacing. I think that's continued. But now really the difference is his shooting has been outstanding. He's shooting 43% from mid-range and 44% on three-pointers.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's this kind of parallel. While Isaiah Thomas made the All-Star game last year, even though our friend Tim Bontemps called him, I think, a fake All-Star on my podcast, that Kemba, you know, has really added to his offensive repertoire, become a more complete player on that end, and is helping carry them. And so last couple of years, you know, Charlotte has gotten just enough on the offensive end. And now it feels like it's a little bit more sustainable and that they can carry this through. And that's exciting because that not only makes them a better regular season team, but it also makes them a theoretically more potent playoff team, because you need that to succeed even against, let's say, the teams that are in the, you know, kind of in that middle morass. I mean, I'm not saying they're threatening Cleveland or anything, but that they can do that is definitely a good sign.
One concerning sign for Charlotte: Frank Kaminsky, ninth on the team in minutes played, only shooting 28% from three-point range. Remember last year, he shot really in the low 30s. And for a guy who is supposed to be ready, who was supposed to be a great shooter, just has not been able to put it together in terms of actually making shots. Now, he does still have the gravity. He has that reputation of being a good shooter. At some point, maybe that changes, but he's got to shoot. I mean, when you see what the other limitations of his game are, at some point, if he's going to be even a good rotation player, he's going to need to shoot at least 35% on threes. He hasn't gotten there yet and has been providing little else.
Yeah, it's this weird challenge when you're dealing with someone like Kaminsky that, you know, that doesn't do a lot of the traditional big man stuff, is that you definitely need them to provide other value. And at this point, he's not doing either thing. And so you can get there, you know, guys certainly do with time. But yeah, as you said, he's an older sophomore. You know, you get into those kind of circumstances and you start to wonder about it. And I don't want to relitigate any of the other stuff, but there are certain guys that they would be looking better if they had them on the roster.
Worth noting, though, that they did play pretty well with him on the floor last year, as I recall. And then this year, 11 net rating with him out there, too. So his gravity, I think, does help. And they haven't been getting killed on defense with him out there either. 97 points per 100 defensive rating when he has played. So that's, I mean, Kaminsky, a guy who may be a little underrated by his traditional stats. Are we ready to move on?
Yes, to your Chicago Bulls. I'm still calling them that.
Well, the fact that Rondo hasn't played in two of the last three crunch times makes me feel a little bit better about it, embracing them. That's been very interesting. He played very well against Miami, and something that we noted offline when we did our practice Twitter NBA show was that was good Rondo on Thursday, that he basically is, maybe he'll get to 50% from the field. He might turn it over on only 15% of his possessions instead of 25%, and his defense will still be lacking. Like, he had one huge lapse that on a Tyler Johnson three where he blew a switch. Tyler Johnson just missed a wide open three that could have tied it up late in that game against Miami the other day. He just has a lot of blown assignments, missed assignments. We've seen even some quotes in the media from guys like Jimmy Butler about, hey, we're not on the same page. We go over it on the scouting report, and then we blow the assignment. We're switching a lot where we're not supposed to be switching. That's a Rondo special as well. And it'll be very interesting to see how long, I mean, Rondo really has struggled as well. At this point, he is 388 true shooting, turning it over on 20% of his possessions, which is actually down from previous years, shooting extremely poorly on twos outside the paint as well. And he's just such a bad fit with Wade and Butler, especially down the stretch when he's not going to get guarded. So and Isaiah Cannon is going to play, but he's really not someone who should probably be starting. I would like to see them maybe even just go with a backcourt of only Wade and Butler. But McDermott now has actually got his second concussion of the season after a hard foul by Markieff Morris last night. So who knows how long he could be out. He apparently was just like not even close to there. Taj Gibson said it after the game. So I like what this team has been able to do. They're playing Robin Lopez more now defensively. Taj Gibson is having a nice season. There is talent here. I think, though, they're going to have some challenges with using all these guys correctly. But especially, the biggest reason for optimism, though, is that Jimmy Butler just continues to kick ass.
Yeah, and that's exactly where I wanted to go with this, is Butler has been excellent. Kind of whatever metric you want to use, he's doing really well. He's, I believe, ninth in the league in PER, 63 true shooting percentage, which is great, 26% usage, so he's kind of reaching that threshold, you know, in terms of efficiency and usage. And I think he's looked, I don't know if you agree with me, I think he's looked better defensively this year than last year.
I think that's true. He also looks to have gotten his bounce back, which he looked pretty unathletic during Team USA after that knee injury that he suffered in Denver last year. And he got up for a couple of nice alley-oops, like head at the rim type of plays. So that was encouraging as well. He has been shooting extremely well on threes, just like this whole team has. We'll talk a little bit more about that perhaps when we talk about some of the surprises. A few other notes here. When they've gone to their bench with just Wade as the impetus, no Butler, they have not played well. They've not played well with Butler off the floor. And then Nikola Mirotic continues to basically just become a three-point specialist. I wrote about this when I did the Insider ESPN Insider previews for the Bulls, that with the amount of other guys who are going to create, that Mirotic probably is just going to keep shooting more three-pointers. And now he's shooting 64% of his shots from three. McDermott, on the other hand, is only shooting 33% of his shots from three. He went through a stretch where he made one three-pointer in about five or six games. So the teams are overplaying him for that. He does have more ability to score, but he shoots it so well from three that it would be nice if he could get more threes off. What else you got on these guys?
Two other, you can call them, defining characteristics of the season so far for them. One is they have been the best offensive rebounding team in the league, which is very interesting. And then the other one is, I started getting into some of it's small sample size theater for sure, but the shot clock data in terms of when teams shoot, and the Bulls have attempted the smallest amount of free throw attempts, and I scaled it per possession, in the final 4 seconds of the shot clock, and that's just
smallest amount of field goal attempts,
yes.
Yeah.
And that is a notable sign. That means they're getting into things early. That means they're not, because this is a team you could imagine that would have a lot of trouble late, except for those Wade just saving the team shots. And they haven't had to.
Although part of that could be skewed, and now that I think about it. And that's what the shot clock data is always tough to parse out.
Right.
Because of offensive rebounds as well. I mean, and to figure, because that's a big reason why, if they're getting so many offensive rebounds, they're probably going straight back up or with a lot of those shots. So, I mean, I'm not to say that that's not a useful stat, but it's, I just kind of wish that we had a little bit better of a way to show the transition. I think Nylon Calculus at one point had that, but they haven't had a chance to update their stats yet. It looks like this year.
We didn't mention their record, but the Bulls are 6-4. So now we'll move to the Cavaliers, who are 7-1, and they are playing, as we record this, against the Hornets and Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. He is playing tonight.
So one thing that we're going to reference here a little bit for some of these teams is SRS, which is basically just a schedule adjusted point differential from Basketball Reference. Despite being 7-1, the Cavs are only 7th in that metric. I think the big reason for that is their defense. They're 2nd in offense, 13th in defense so far. And I mean, that's kind of about what we expect from this team during the regular season. They don't need to be any better than that. They have a history of turning up their defense quite a bit in the playoffs. And there's no other teams in the East that can keep up with them offensively. Anyway, I think one thing that they've done now that they have Channing Frye is that they just play other team centers off the floor. And some of their competition, they have pretty good centers, you know, the Raptors being one of those, with Valanciunas, who of course was hurt last year and didn't play that much in that series, but he might not play that much if they play this year either, because they just go with Frye or Love at center. And yeah, those guys aren't great defensive players, but you still have guys like LeBron who can be pretty versatile defensively. And with Frye or Love at center, if you have a traditional center, there's just no way of dealing with it. Like the Wizards just didn't play Marcin Gortat at all in the fourth quarter, because, and he's one of their best players at this point in time, because Love and Frye just space him out.
And while a lot of people would probably make the parallel to the Warriors death lineup, the one that I think is actually more pertinent here is Oklahoma City, when they went to what I called the Megadeth lineup. And the reason for that is because they got a lot of the defensive stuff by having the LeBron Durant parallel is there. Like, LeBron can be a good help defender. Durant was very good in the playoffs. And also because that is not a criticism of the guy they normally have at center. Tristan Thompson's a solid player. It's just that having him off the floor in those circumstances unleashes other elements that they have, including Amon Shumpert, who has done a better job this year than when he really struggled last year.
Yeah, he has been fantastic. He's shooting 53% on threes. You remember he started last year with that wrist injury and really never got going. He looked looked like he was a little heavier than he'd like to be. He reportedly lost weight during this offseason. He's at a 70% true shooting, although extremely low usage, 12%, but that's, I think, what he needs to do. He's been playing a lot. They have not been using a traditional point guard hardly at all. Kate Felder played like his first 7 minutes of the season against Washington the other night and did okay, but Shumpert has been playing more. He's been playing as, you know, guarding point guards and then playing with LeBron James on the second unit. And I think that's a huge development for their matchup against Golden State, because Shumpert really was not playable offensively in their playoff series last year. I think he was playing like under 10 minutes a game in the finals. But now he can, as someone who could guard Steph Curry, who can pick up for Kyrie Irving as well defensively when needed, can guard Klay Thompson. He did a great job on Klay Thompson in the 2015 finals. All of that, I think, could be useful, and he could be a part of some of their best lineups. We're going to talk about this a ton, because I think these teams still look like the favorites, although the Clippers may have something to say about that to get to the finals. With this Love at center, Fry at center thing, no East team really can deal with that. Maybe Boston can with Horford, but even he might be a little hard pressed to guard someone like Fry or Love. But Golden State can deal with that, right? They have the guys who can switch. They have Green at center, and Fry, you know, can't really play at all against Golden State. At least that's what Lou thought in the finals. So that's really the biggest reason I think that Golden State can match up well with them, in addition to, you know, being maybe the one team that offensively can keep up with them also. Whereas if there were to be another finals matchup, the Clippers with DeAndre Jordan, the Spurs, you know, that LaMarcus Aldridge, those teams are going to really struggle to deal with a lineup of Love or Fry at center.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And something else I wanted to note that's just, it's significant to a point, is that while Cleveland is second in offense, and that's great, Kevin Love's only shooting 31% from three. Like, you think that there's more space in this, though. Something that they've done really well is they're shooting a lot more corner threes than anybody else. They're at 9.5 per game. The next closest team is 8.1, so that's a pretty significant difference. And they're making 44.7% of those, which is fourth in the league.
Yeah, that's pretty good. And getting a large number of corner threes is generally a sign of a healthy offense, because we know that defenses really try to take that away. Love, I talked about this a little bit with Bontemps on Tuesday night, that I think when you're going with Love at center, just the poison that I would probably pick is just leaving him open for threes, because while he is a good volume shooter and he has a ton of gravity, I think that teams actually maybe respect his three-pointer a little bit more than his actual results would suggest. And his talent, certainly spacing the floor and being able to get those shots off, is big, but he's not really a knockdown guy. He's not a 40% guy. He's like this American white dude who shoots a lot of threes. So you think that we can't let this guy shoot. But yeah, as you mentioned, he's at 31% this year. Really, I think probably like 36-37% probably for his Cavs career. Never only been above 40%, I think, 1 year in his career. So it's more the volume that's really impressive than his accuracy. So I might let him, you know, say, all right, we're just going to close out on this guy a little bit softer. And if he beats us, he beats us. It's not a great option, but it might be the best for some of these Eastern Conference teams that feel like they want to still play a traditional center. The other thing noting too is LeBron actually not shooting incredibly well from the field so far. He's under 50% and still at 28% on threes. A little bit better, 36% on long twos. But while he did have that brief renaissance with the jumper when he was really killing it against Golden State, doesn't look like that's something that's going to be reliable throughout the whole season, despite the fact that he supposedly worked on it. Maybe it'll improve, but so far, still looking like the guy that he's been the last year and a half or so with his jump shot.
Ready to move on to Detroit?
5-5 for the Pistons. They had a nice start, went on a Western trip against some pretty mediocre teams, but then had a nice win against Denver on Saturday night. The big issue for them so far is the offense. They are number three in opponent field goal percentage after being 16th last year. And that's actually pretty impressive. I think Andre Drummond has come around a little bit defensively. Could still just be, you know, the fact that we've only gone through 1/8 of the season so far. But when you consider Morris, Harris, Ish Smith, not a great defensive player. Baines is not really that good. John Luer is in the rotation. Stanley Johnson is a second year guy. Beno Udrich is their backup point guard. Other than Drummond and KCP, really not any other good defenders on this roster. roster. So to be as good as they are, both in E field goal percentage and just sixth in general on defense, that's encouraging for this team. And the problem, though, is just on offense.
Well, yeah, and you could look at the offense in a lot of different ways, but the one that I keyed in on, while you're dealing, again, small sample size theater, they have the league's worst net rating in clutch situations. They're getting outscored by 46.1 points per 100 possessions. And the reason...
Do you remember, how many minutes was that? Do you remember?
I think it's around like 18 or so. But the thing is, they have a 56.6 offensive rating. And the thing that struck me, I was watching I can't remember which one of their close games it was. It reminded me so much of the Jazz when they were flailing last year without a point guard. And then the Sixers basically all of last year, incidentally, except for the time that they had Ish Smith, where they just couldn't really figure things out. And that's why getting Reggie Jackson back will fix a lot of that. It kind of gets them back to an equilibrium, especially in terms of their pick and roll offense. So it's not a long-term concern in that way, but you do want it. It's part of the reason why I'm somebody who pushes for as many capable ball handlers as you can fit on your roster.
Ish Smith, they're 5-5. He's the starting point guard. He's also shooting 10% from three, 23% on long twos, 34% overall, 38% true shooting, and still a pretty high usage, 21%. So that's bad in the sense that, hey, maybe this guy hasn't fixed their backup point guard problems. And you mentioned the difficulty defensively and or offensively late in games. And when you really lock in on Smith, you can go under on him quite a bit, force him to shoot the jump shot. But yeah, once Reggie Jackson gets back, maybe this offense gets to be better. Encouraging at least that Tobias Harris and KCP both shooting pretty well on threes. Harris in particular looks very, very comfortable from three early in the season. And then also I think if they get Reggie back, they won't have to go to these Drummond post-ups that we're now on year three under Stan Van Gundy, where they're still going to these and, you know, they don't work.
They don't. And I think he's gotten a little bit better, but that's kind of the low bar issue. And, Drummond has a lot of gifts. I think he's gotten better defensively. He's the league's best offensive rebounder, in my opinion. But he's still not great in terms of touch and finishing around the basket. So there are a couple different ways you can handle that. You can kind of do the Tristan Thompson, grab the rebound, pass it out type of thing. Or, just try, because the other problem with him is you don't want him to get fouled. So that's one of the ways that you can mitigate a guy who doesn't have great touch around the basket. One, they can try to dunk everything. And two, they can try to get fouled, but he's a bad free throw shooter, so you can't really do that either.
Yeah, for Drummond, he's already 54 post-up possessions that he's finished in 10 games. So basically five possessions a game they're using on that. And he's in the 21st percentile overall in the league. He also is really bad at converting his offensive rebounds, as you mentioned. And I think a lot of that is just because they're kind of wild tips off the backboard that are being counted as shots. And you might say, all right, well, maybe the reason he's so inefficient on those plays is because he's getting fouled, but he's really not getting fouled that much, only like 10% of the time on either of those plays. I think that's because opponents are like, well, he's not that efficient anyway. Why pick up a foul? One other interesting thing on this team, even with Drummond, who has been fantastic on the glass, they're only 18th in offensive rebounding percentage and 15th in defensive rebounding percentage. And that's because they're playing, really two combo forwards. And so they're relying on Drummond to essentially get every rebound. And I don't think that's the end of the world. You'd like a team to have that has the league's best rebounder to be better overall at rebounding. But the other approach you can take is, well, maybe because this guy is so good at rebounding, now we can use other guys, more combo forwards, guys who aren't as good at rebounding, go with a scheme that's going to pressure up more on the perimeter, get out and transition more, leak guys out. And so you just use how good he is to just be adequate and try to then take advantage in other areas. Let's move on to the Pacers, 4-6, and that probably overstates how good they have been at this point. They are 25th in that basketball reference metric. They have not had a difficult schedule at all. The biggest problem is the defense. It really has been a struggle for them. Their last three games against Philly again, and then Boston without Horford and Crowder. Two of those were at home. They went 1-2. Paul George with a sprained ankle missed this last game against Boston. And when George has been out, this team has been like well into the negative.
And we talked a lot during the offseason about why we were lower on them than a lot of people. We actually talked about that as well in the Time to Panic episode. And, there are ways that they can try to mitigate part of it. I was encouraged that they put CJ Miles in the starting lineup. That is something that could potentially help some of that, but they just don't have enough defenders on their roster.
I guess that's a good point, right? Turner, for all of his shot blocking prowess, has been pretty foul prone. He wasn't able to stay on the floor against Joel Embiid in that game against Philly. And when they go to their bench, it's really bad. Al Jefferson, Lavoy Allen, and Kevin Serafin, all three of those guys, they have worse than a 110 defensive rating, which would be basically worse than a league level. When those guys are on the floor, not a surprise with Al Jefferson. We know that he was really protected defensively by Steve Clifford these last few years, and Nate McMillan has not shown that level of acumen so far. And they've been pretty decent in close games. They managed to come back against Indiana. Like, that was even a against Philly. That was even a close win. Like, they probably should have lost that game, too, at home against Philly without Joel Embiid.
Well, I mean, what you mentioned when they have their 3-2 in close games, they're also, I think, two of those five were against the Sixers, who are just a horrendous team in crunch time most of the time.
Yeah, that's true. We'll have to talk about that when we get to them. Another note is that you can tell that Nate McMillan is really starting to search for things now. He changed up and put CJ Miles in the starting lineup, which I thought was a needed move to get a little more defense and shooting with that first unit. That's meant that Joe Young hasn't played as much. He's been out of the rotation. Aaron Brooks has been okay. They've got Ellis now playing more with the second unit to try to get some scoring there. That's not going to help that second unit defense that's getting worked without Paul George in the game. And then they also even closed that game against the Celtics that they lost with Lavoy Allen instead of Thaddeus Young, which didn't make any sense to me. Allen was basically, like, at the time when he was making that decision, Allen was like negative 11 and was 1-for-6, and Thaddeus Young was plus 6 and he had 10 points. So I didn't see anything about Young's performance why he needed to get taken out. But I guess the thought was, all right, we have to just play better defense. And maybe he thought that Lavoy Allen was that, but that can't necessarily have warmed Larry Bird's heart, since wanting to play with two traditional bigs and leaning on guys like Allen so much was something that I think Bird wanted to move away from when he sacked Frank Vogel.
Oh, yeah. You know, nothing says run and gun like playing Lavoy Allen at the four.
Yeah, so those 4-6 Pacers, they are currently 16th in offense and 24th in defense. So that, and again, I mean, have they played even a single team that's like in the 10 best teams of the league so far? I don't think they have. I guess Charlotte would be the only one, and they got blown out by them.
Yeah, Charlotte. I think Charlotte would be there, but yeah, that doesn't exactly help their case.
Well, I actually am going to go see the aforementioned Indiana Pacers play the Warriors on Monday, a week from Monday, actually. And my girlfriend is going to be in town. I'm just making the trip from Chicago. And so we decided to buy some tickets, and we decided to get them off of SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the best place to buy tickets because they aggregate multiple ticket sites together. So they do all the work. You don't have to go to 8 sites, and then the 9th one, you're worried that you might have missed out on a deal. Now you can have the peace of mind that you're seeing the best deals in front of you. SeatGeek also tells you which tickets are a good deal or a bad deal using their deal score metric. That's a nice little ranking feature that they provide. So you can just, again, you don't have to compare a ton. You know that this deal is well priced compared to some of the others, and you can just go ahead and select it on your phone. The free SeatGeek app is very easy to use. And of course, you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase by going into the settings tab, clicking on add a promo code, and entering that code CAPSPACE. That's all one word, easy to remember. We talk about it all the time on the program. And after you make your first purchase, SeatGeek will send you $20. So that's the free SeatGeek app. Going into the settings tab, add a promo code, enter that CAPSPACE code to get $20 off. Also let them know that you came from us, and happy hunting on deals with SeatGeek. The Miami Heat, now 2-6, surprisingly actually 13th in SRS, although they're still in the negative because some of these teams, you know, like the Clippers have like a 17 SRS, which is completely insane. So Miami has been about kind of what I expected them to be. They've been a little unlucky in close games. The defense has been solid. But again, this is another one of these teams now where Eric Spoelstra is starting to search. He went with Derek Williams, who was basically had to be exhumed to get him on the court. He hadn't played at all really in the first 6-7 games. He took Hassan Whiteside out of that game against the Jazz very early in the third quarter, even though he only had one foul, basically as a teaching moment. Didn't think he was playing hard, and Rudy Gobert was dominating him. I think Whiteside was only 3 out of 10 in that game. Many of them post-ups against Gobert, and Whiteside just still not a good post-up option, although he certainly would love to be. What else stands out to you about this team?
Well, so Goran Dragic tweaked his ankle against the Bulls, and he's, so it's kind of a good news, bad news. The good news is he's day to day. The bad news is I think I heard that he's in a walking boot, which is always kind of a little bit concerning me, even though the x-rays were negative.
That actually is the sixth left ankle sprain that Jeff Stotts has in his database for Dragic.
Wow. And they're a team that relies so heavily on Dragic to create for them because they have other talented guards, but Tyler Johnson and Josh Richardson are both more secondary guys. And they do well in that role. They can defend both guard positions. They can do all that. But when you're relying on them to generate offense for other guys, it's a problem. And if you want to throw those reins to Dion Waiters, by all means, but that's going to have its own problems with itself. And Whiteside, you know, Whiteside's a talented guy, but that's not what he's best at. He's best at maximizing the opportunities created by others. He has nice
gravity
as a role guy.
Yeah, his efficiency is way down because they've been trying to post him up this year, and he's just not good at that.
But one thing that they can kind of hang their hat on as they move into, you know, this new phase, whatever that's going to be, is that they're still doing well defensively. Like, I mean, they're second in opponent effective field goal percentage. They're just doing a good job fighting on that end, contesting. Their personnel in some ways is favorable. Whiteside should be a good defender. Justice Winslow, of course. But it's kind of confirming to me that Spo is a good coach. He just is in a really tough situation.
Yeah, I like their defensive personnel. That's why I thought that this team could still be competitive this year. And of course, even though they have been competitive, 2-6 so far, you wonder when the switch is just going to be turned off into tank mode, potentially a Dragic trade as well. Although again, these free agent dreams, there's South Beach, but I don't care how much space you have. You just won 20 games. You're not going to be exactly a hotbed for free agency. But again, just the fact that they have their pick this year is pretty important for them.
Especially considering their future obligations. Like, you kind of need to maximize that opportunity when you can get it. When you have two picks that are outlaid, like you have that kind of a situation, you just need to make sure it's something, you know, Sacramento never really did with their existing obligations, was they played well enough to weaken their own picks and then didn't draft very well. Miami can learn from that and push a little bit farther. And that's what they did when they got Winslow in the first place.
Josh Richardson returned from his sprained MCL about a week ago, had two rough games, and then he actually played a lot more. Did come off the bench against Chicago, but played well, closed that game. And then he actually started at point guard against Utah, and I thought played pretty well. Like, his jumper just looks really good to me. Like, he's shooting off the dribble. He looks like a shooter. You know, last year we were like, I can't believe he's shooting this well from three. Who is this guy? You know, he's shooting 53% down the end of the year. And most of those were just spot up looks. They had a lot more options to create, but now he's looked okay in pick and roll. And just, I mean, again, it's too early to say just in terms of the statistics, but just watching him shoot, he just looks very comfortable shooting his shot. It looks to have some more versatility to it, taking some harder attempts. I really like that. Defensively, though, he is a little bit miscast trying to guard threes at this point, and maybe forever. He's, you know, about 6'4", 6'5", a thinner guy. He's much more of a 1-2 defender than someone who can lock down in the wing. Like, he got abused by Jimmy Butler. That was something that we talked about on our practice Twitter NBA show as well, that they put Winslow on Wade, and then that left Richardson on Butler, and Butler was just too big for him. Same thing with Gordon Hayward, too, when Richardson would get switched onto him in that Jazz game, wasn't able to deal with his size and was getting bumped off. They were just able to rise up over him. But that's all right. They have Justice Winslow to hopefully guard those guys. But the problem, I guess, with Richardson is he's got to guard some of these larger players because they have a lot of guards and they don't really have anyone at the three and four. I mean, the only decent traditional three or four that they have on this roster right now is Winslow. And even he is struggling with his shooting. But even defensively, they just have nothing at the four. So that leads me to this question. Assuming Dragic can get back and healthy, and maybe they can make a push to make this season respectable before tank mode happens, what do you see as their best lineup?
So you obviously start with Dragic and Whiteside, so then you're really talking about the two through the four, and you can kind of take your pick between Richardson and Johnson. I think Richardson fits better with that combination, but I'm a big Tyler Johnson fan as well, but I'll go with Richardson. Then Winslow gets one of those other spots. I would have him at the four just because I like Winslow a lot more at the three, but they just don't really have a guy at the four to justify pushing him that direction. So I'd probably go with Waiters as the last guy. He's strong. He can do some different things out there. there. And, you know,
I would love to go with Waiters too. I think he actually, his on-ball defense has been excellent this year. He's strong. We saw that he is pretty decent on switches. He's got long arms. He's got that barrel chest to where he can avoid getting back down. The only problem is he's shooting 34% at the rim, 25% in the paint. And really the only shot that he's made with any kind of consistency is a three-pointer. He's still below average on that. So if he's just going to shoot 33% from the field, you just can't play him offensively, which was probably a surprise people would have said about him when he was drafted. But I mean, I think clearly their five best players to me are Richardson, Tyler Johnson, Winslow, Dragic, and Whiteside. It's just a question of, do they have enough size defensively? I mean, maybe what you have to do is just use that quickness to double team a lot if you get into a bad matchup, but just try to switch other than that.
So yeah, it also ties in with this dynamic that I've been watching for Miami for a little while now, which is that they are attempting the most field goal attempts in the restricted area, but are also the least efficient. They're making the lowest proportion of them in the league, and I think that's something worth watching moving forward.
Yeah, and the aforementioned Waiters, a big problem with that. We talked about Justice Winslow on the Twitter NBA show as well, having some of the same issues finishing at the rim too. So those guys, and part of the problem is just that there's no spacing also, which is a huge concern. I think at least Richardson's shooting should help with that, and I'd like to see finally what they can do with actually having two decent playmakers in Richardson and Dragic in the backcourt. Let's move on to the surprising Milwaukee Bucks, now 5-4 after a nice win at home against Memphis yesterday. They had kind of tricked a few games late, and one of those against Brooklyn they probably should have lost, and then Jabari was able to miss a layup and John Henson got a tip in. Jason Kidd has been doing his usual rotation roulette with everyone not named Jabari and Giannis. Jason Terry has played only four games but has closed a bunch of them. He plays like 20 minutes a game in the games that he plays. Miles Plumlee was starting, then they went to John Henson to start against Memphis, which didn't make a ton of sense because he had to match up against Marc Gasol. And then Greg Monroe has been closing some games. Greg has been just his normal, incredibly efficient self on offense, though he takes a bit off the table for this team with his inability to shoot. But I mean, that's what this team is doing right now. They're just bludgeoning teams in the restricted area.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason why I'm really excited to see them play Miami on Thursday, because Hassan Whiteside, you know, he's not a perfect defender, but he can do a good job of trying to alter and affect shots there. And so to really see how that works, they also face Dwight Howard and the Hawks on Wednesday. So it'll be a nice test of how well these things can proceed moving forward with different things. And just also, one thing I wanted to note, you talked about how they've tried a lot of different stuff. What I think we would both probably expect to be their starting lineup, their primary starting lineup for the rest of the year, is Dellavedova, Snell, Giannis, Jabari, and Miles Plumlee. They're plus 12.8 in only 85 minutes played, and part of that's because Tony Snell had to make his way onto this team.
Yeah, he started the season with a sprained ankle. I think the most encouraging thing for this team right now is the defense, ninth in the NBA. They were obviously terrible last year, but really getting Dellavedova back, Jabari hasn't been as awful. Giannis has been fantastic defensively. He's blocking 5% of opponents' twos. That's like center level of shot, like good center level of shot blocking. Getting a ton of steals as well. And the centers like haven't been taken advantage of too badly. Now, they haven't played any great teams so far, to be sure. But they're still in SRS. They're 16th in the league, still in the negative. And the offense has been good too. I mean, above average in both offense and defense. I don't think either of us expected that from this team, and that's where they've been so far.
Yeah, it's a nice little run for them, and we don't know whether it'll continue, but you can take solace in that they've done what they should do, and that can get you a long way in the regular season.
And the big thing for them, though, in the long term is just that Jabari and Giannis look really, really good. Jabari's jump shooting has really transformed. He's shooting over 40% from three, looks very comfortable taking it out there, and they really needed that, especially if you're going to play, because none of their centers can shoot, and Giannis still can't shoot at all. That's one problem that he's had, is he still he takes 55% of his shots in the restricted area. He shoots 75% on those, but then he's basically shooting like less than 30% from every other zone. And Jabari, on the other hand, do the next step for him, for some reason he just doesn't get foul calls when he goes up in the restricted area too. So I don't know why that is. Guys just kind of bounce off him, and he doesn't have the greatest craft when it's not a dunk. But I mean, for Giannis to be at 28% usage, Jabari at 26, both of them improving their efficiency as well, that's all you can ask for. And then they're getting enough from some of these support players. Michael Beasley has been very efficient scoring as well, to provide maybe one more creator on the second unit. He actually has been playing a little bit more, eating into some of Teletovich's minutes. lately. Teletovic is shooting pretty well. The only downside here is Delly, Snell, Malcolm Brogdon. Like, those guys are all shooting like 30% or less on three-pointers right now. And so it would be nice if those guys could start hitting their shots. And that if that happens, then this might actually be like a pretty difficult team to stop. I want to see what happens once the scouting report gets out there on Giannis and Jabari and whether teams can start to shut them down.
And they're a team that benefits, while of course it's early, from the lack of real dominant teams at kind of the bottom end of the East playoff picture, that if they just keep scrapping and winning the games they should win and then winning a couple other ones, that might be enough to put them in contention.
The whole point Giannis thing, he is only averaging 5.3 assists, which is not that much. This is a team that doesn't get a ton of assists overall, especially I think down the end of games, again, because they just don't necessarily have the spacing to really bang it around the perimeter, but they do attack switches really well. I think that's one of Kidd's preferred styles, and maybe a better one with this roster when you don't necessarily have the spacing. Anything else pop out to you about their start? I'm sure we're going to talk about them a lot more on the surprise starts. Can they sustain it podcast?
No, I think we'll save it for that and move on to the Knicks, who are 3-6. And there are some, you know, some positive things and some negative things. But one thing that's been frustrating to me, and this was something that we expected kind of going into the season with the personnel moves they made, is that we've seen very little of Porzingis at center. And part of that's because those lineups haven't been too great.
No, they haven't. But a lot of their lineups haven't been great. I mean, and the big problem for the Knicks is just where their defense is right now. They're 3-6. Their defense down the stretch, I watched their game against Toronto last night, just atrocious. It was a 1-4 pick and roll. Porzingis was guarding Patterson. Rose was guarding Kyle Lowry. And they must have miscommunicated like four plays in a row. And they gave up a wide open Patterson three on one of them. Lowry was just able to drive right by Rose when Porzingis was helping in the wrong spot, or they didn't call it out. Rose didn't force him to the right place. I don't know whose fault it necessarily was, but the communication was terrible. And then it highlighted too that Noah really has not been effective at all at the rim. There's been a bunch of times where he hasn't jumped. When he does jump, they go right around him. He really just has not been the defensive force that you would have hoped. They haven't had him really moving his feet or switching out in the perimeter either. And it's just kind of been a little bit of a disaster defensively. And this is the year that Noah was actually supposed to really still be good and help them, and he's still not helping them. It's really a concern. Like, they're lucky to be 3-6. Expected one loss is 2-7. They are 26th out of 30 in SRS right now. Defense is 30th. Offense only 18th. So they're kind of like the Pacers, but an even worse version of it so far.
Yeah. And again, they can get Lance Thomas back, and that would, you know, Lance Thomas has been kind of limited, I guess would probably be the best word for it so far. That can
help. Like Kuzminskas was playing over him yesterday. I didn't really understand that at all.
So they're in this tough spot where, you know, this isn't necessarily the high watermark for them of this era, like as a franchise overall, because we think Porzingis can carry them. But
yeah, that's
a lot
the good
of their
news.
Guys
like,
are
Porzingis,
age. He's
Porzingis
been great.
Looks really good. Like that's, he's been getting in foul trouble a lot, and he doesn't hit the offensive glass at all anymore. Like that was really truly a mirage from the first month or so of his career. But he's been shooting really well. 60% true shooting. Like that was the big problem with him last year, was he actually wasn't that efficient. Now he's over that 24% usage. So Derrick Rose, of course, still 26% usage. and they're probably, there's not been enough pick and pop with Porzingis and Rose still, which has been a disappointment. But honestly, like the starters have actually been okay. They've been right around even with the starters on the floor. It's just their bench has been getting destroyed.
And that's the part that's a concern, that it's a lot harder to rectify this season because they don't have a lot of tools to get better. They don't really have, you know, unless they want to trade their first round pick or something crazy like that. So they can change around, maybe stagger a little bit, but even staggering a little bit, I'm not sure that that sustains it in a way, especially because you have to then replace those players with the other starter.
Yeah, and Noah, for all we've complained about him, they actually have been pretty good offensively when he's been on the floor. I think that's more just because he's playing mostly with the starting lineup. They haven't stopped anyone when he's been out there. And then Courtney Lee is really their only defensive option at all on the wing. Rose has been really bad defensively also. And Porzingis, for all of his brilliance, they've been negative 8.6 when he's been on the floor. And as you mentioned, they just, his defense in space has been problematic. That's something that I thought was going to be a problem for him last year. They even have had times where they've had Porzingis defend the center. And when they went against a shooting four like Patterson yesterday, they had Noah defend him. And then when they went away from that to have Porzingis guard Patterson, then they went right at Porzingis in pick and roll defense. So he has been fantastic offensively. He's been cutting nicely, finishing so much better at the rim, as we've talked about. So I think his future is still bright, but for this team right now, they're going to turn it around pretty quickly, or it's going to get very ugly. I mean, and some of these net ratings for the bench guys, I mean, Justin Holiday, negative 17, Lance Thomas, negative 16, Brandon Jennings, negative 16, Willie Hernan Gomez, who was christened the backup center and then immediately lost that job again to Kyle O'Quinn, who played well last night. He's negative 21. It's just been so, so ugly for that bench. What's their schedule look like coming up? Is there any relief on the schedule, or could they be, you know, looking at being totally out of it here within the next 6, 7, 8 games?
So they kind of have this weird thing where they play a lot of home games, so that's a good thing for them, but they're against middling teams, so that's actually in a way a nice test. So home against Dallas and Detroit, then at the Wizards, and then another 3-game homestand, Hawks, then Blazers and Hornets. So actually that part's rough. So they're going to have to survive it. They're going to kind of have to pull through. And, you know, they do have...
Yeah. But even those teams you mentioned, if this team is a 500 team like they hope to be, like those games are still toss-ups at home. You know, sure. A 500 team, unless you're playing like the Warriors or something, if you're just playing, you know, sort of like a decent playoff team, that's like, you got a 50% chance of winning those games at home. So if they... Yeah, I mean, that stretch is difficult, but it's not like a killer. And if they continue to be, you know, win only two-thirds of their games over this next stretch, I mean, that's it. They're going to be done. They haven't even had like any West road trips yet or anything. They usually have those late in the season, so it's they better get it together quickly, or, you know, and obviously New York is not exactly the most patient market, and there are going to be a lot of questions.
Yeah, certainly. Ready to move on to another team that's in a rosy, fun situation?
Yeah, I mean, the Knicks were one. The Magic, another 3-6 team that actually 3-6 overstates how good they have been so far.
Yeah, I mean, so they're the bottom of the league in Basketball Reference's SRS, and really what that indicates is that they've had an easy schedule and they have not done well against.
Yeah, and Frank Vogel now is starting to search, as we've seen with a lot of these teams, Hornacek as well. Aaron Gordon actually moved to the bench on Friday with Jeff Green as the starting small forward, and as you noted, he went 1-for-6 from the field in that loss to the Jazz. He was playing the three, and they actually rejiggered things on the bench. Hezonja didn't play at all in that game, and they put in Rudej so that Gordon could still play at the three off the bench. Still has not played well, not getting any minutes at the four really at all this year. Serge Ibaka has not been that good either. And they're not getting out in transition at all. You would hope that this team could get some stops. They have some athletes. Elfrid Payton could be a good transition guy. Gordon could run the floor, but they're playing, I think, at basically the slowest pace in the league. And there's not much of a silver lining here because they don't really do anything well right now from a statistical standpoint, at least not anything important.
Yeah, I mean, they're not turning the ball over, hooray, and they're forcing other teams to shoot mid-range jumpers, but that's really about it. And something that I noticed is that they also have the least deflections per game, and part of that is that they're playing at a slow pace. So, you know, that is not a per possession, it is a total stat, but when you're dead last, that's a problem too.
How are they 27th in defensive rebounding with the guys they have on this team
when you're playing Aaron Gordon at the three because you have too many big men?
Wait, but why would that make you worse at defensive
rebounding? That's like what I'm saying. It's completely insane.
Yeah, I mean, Biombo is a great defensive rebounder. Vucevic a little better on the offensive end, but still a guy who gets a lot of rebounds. Ibaka's rebounding has fallen off in recent years, but still a guy who can jump. He should be above average as a power forward. Payton is fine as a point guard. I really just don't understand how they can be, and that just shows that they're, I think the effort has not been there. And player, even, you know, we knew they were going to be bad on offense. Like, there's no way they weren't going to be, but it really seems like, I don't know whether it's the issue of Biombo having been signed and making more money than Vucevic now, whether it's a new coach with Vogel and he's kind of being a taskmaster and that people aren't buying in. I don't know what it is, but this team really, you have to say, is not trying hard enough, because even the things that this personnel theoretically should be good at, they're not good at.
Yeah, and they do have other kind of alignments and personnel things they can do, but will those fix their problems is something that I'm not super comfortable with at this moment.
No, I don't see what the path is. I mean, they just just have to start defending. I mean, that's the biggest thing. And again, like, I don't know how they're forcing no turnovers with athletic guys that they have on this team, not really blocking many shots. Like, it is, and then on offense, of course, it's a train wreck because they have one player with an above average true shooting percentage on the entire team, and that's Fournier, and even he's only at 55%, so he's like 1 point above the league average. And everyone, I mean, they have a bunch of guys who are like in the 40s, which is just completely miserable. So yeah, I'm not seeing a ton of hope for these guys, but they do have the talent and maybe they can start getting it together. But you can tell that Vogel now is starting to go to the well of just like, hey, I gotta like start finding something, disciplining people to like, you know, let them know that guys like Gordon and Hezonja, like, you gotta play harder. But I can tell you that Damian Rudej is not the answer either. So it's looking pretty bleak for these guys. Maybe they'll turn it around. They don't have the absolute hardest schedule, but for a team that we thought could win, I mean, both Orlando or all of Orlando, New Orleans, and Miami, I picked the over for all three of those teams because I felt like they would just have young guys and they could defend and be really good and just play hard every night. And Miami is playing hard every night. Even New Orleans has a decent defense, even though they're 1-9 now. But Orlando has just not been able to fulfill that part of the equation at all. And it looks like I'm going to be wrong probably on all three of those teams unless they can turn it around.
Yeah, it's definitely a concern. And you get into the point here now, 10 games in is a little bit early, but the possibility of getting a tailspin as well. I mean, I think about that more a little bit with New Orleans just because of the, you know, the idea of how they struggled last year. But, you know, that is kind of where a team can kind of lose themselves as well. I'm not exactly sure what that would look like with the Magic beyond what they're already not doing.
Well, I mean, what it's going to look like is that I think their management team is that it's going to be it for them, unfortunately. And they've already thrown some, and especially because, you know, Sabonis actually is looking pretty good in Oklahoma City. Like, that doesn't look good. Like, Oladipo would probably be the best player on this team so far, even though he hasn't been like killing it in Oklahoma City. He's been better than anyone that they've had. Not so good. Hezonja is looking like a total failed draft pick. So with all that said, I mean, if they aren't even competitive this year, I mean, it's hard to imagine that their front office is going to survive that, unfortunately.
And they also have this challenge. I've been fiddling with Nick Vucevic things, not that he's a primary component of what's been wrong for them, but just kind of like, well, what do you
do
with him?
They've actually been best defensively when he's been on the floor. I mean, that's what the ridiculous thing has been. Like, guys like Ibaka, Biombo, like, they're defending even worse when those guys are out there.
Yeah, so I mean, but let's say you wanted to move him, like, I think there's a limited market for that, but also just the idea of the uncertainty with Ibaka looming over this whole thing, because, you know, if you start moving more guys in their front court, you could actually get into a narrow spot, especially if Biombo isn't good enough to start.
Sixers, 1-8. They actually won a close game on Friday night. I couldn't believe it. Despite, of course, blowing a 6-point lead in the final minute 30 against Indiana. I mean, basically, like, on our, like, nerd G-chat thread, whenever Philly has, like, a lead late, which has actually been more often than you would think, we always just start speculating about, like, how they're going to blow it because they just have been so bad in close games since very, very early in the Brett Brown era. But, yeah, they actually won one. Embiid, they actually had to take him out for overtime, and he was so upset. He was, like, crying on the bench because he wanted to be out there so badly. They brought him back in, and I forget exactly how it was that they managed to build that lead but at the end, but they finally won one. And then, of course, you know, got destroyed at Atlanta without Embiid yesterday, which is what you're going to expect. Atlanta has completely throttled them twice already, and really with Embiid they've been semi-respectable, only -7 points per 100, without him -15.3, so like even worse than last year.
Yeah, and the biggest difference there, and this is not a big surprise to those of us who've watched a fair amount of the Sixers this year, is that they fall off a cliff defensively. And Embiid is definitely useful in that way. It also doesn't help that their second unit has a lot of shaky defenders on it, but so does their entire team. And the thing that really struck me when we were kind of doing a lot of this prep is Embiid actually has a higher usage percentage than Russell Westbrook.
Yeah, it's really been almost this comedy routine. I mean, I shouldn't say it that way, but it's just been so odd that they're like trying so desperately to maximize his minutes. And, you know, he's getting some pretty decent shots. He hasn't been inefficient. He hasn't been particularly efficient from the floor, but overall he gets fouled enough. He makes his free throws. He's hitting 2/3 of his three pointers, which that's not going to continue, but he's been a weapon out there. And you know, they still haven't played that well, even when he's been out there. This idea that he's going to play 24 minutes. When is he going to play? And then Okafor has this 24 minute limit as well. That's not going to be reevaluated, they said, probably until January. And those guys aren't playing together, of course. Okafor has been basically the same guy as last year. I think I have a little bit more hope for him because if he could just not have to shoot any jumpers and could just be more efficient and focus on like taking better post-up opportunities, then he would probably actually be really efficient right now. He's shooting well at the rim. It's just that they have nobody else to do anything and no spacing around him, so he has to just take a bunch of tough jump shots. I don't know. I think this is just going to continue to be really weird until Simmons gets back, and he'll hopefully provide some stability, because, you know, Sergio is turning the ball over a ton. McConnell is turning the ball over a ton. They don't really have anybody who's shooting particularly well on threes. So they're still really, really struggling offensively.
Yeah, there are a lot of kind of big components that they're having trouble with. They're barely getting to the line. They're second from the bottom in free throw attempt rate. They are not leading the league in turnovers, which is a surprise, but basically that's because they're 0.5% off of first place. It's really close. And then they're also, because of that, largely, they're giving up the most transition opportunities as a percentage of possessions of anybody in the league. And so all of that kind of stuff runs together. I feel like I've been in the mode with them for a couple of years now. It's like, oh, well, they'll figure all that kind of stuff out. And I still believe that, but they're going to need more talent. You know, maybe they're going to need to be healthy with what they have, but they're also probably going to need more guys on top of what they do. But fortunately, they have the means to do that both through the draft and through free agency. And something that isn't in that, like, is kind of outside of their control, but is interesting, is that the Lakers' improved play is probably going to open the door for them getting that pick this year.
Yeah, I guess that's true, huh? It looks like the Lakers have been pretty good so far. We'll talk about,
like,
them.
Even if they're fourth from the bottom, yeah, which I think they'll be better than that, that's enough to make it more likely than not that the Sixers will get it.
Yeah, we're getting a little too far ahead of our Are These Surprises Real podcast for later this week. The biggest stat that stuck out to me about Embiid, he's only shooting 9 out of 24, 37% in the restricted area. For a 7'2 guy, that of course is not good. And he is getting fouled a ton on those plays. That's a big part of his free throw rate. So it's not like he's been ineffective in there. But I wanted to take a look at it. I think a lot of it is simply from the fact that he hasn't played for a while. He's just, and he hasn't had like really that many bad misses. He just will kind of get bumped and like the shot rims out a little bit, or a tip that doesn't quite go down. He does have a propensity for getting stripped or blocked a little bit more, but, you know, when you're going against chairs, they don't really have very long arms, so you're not used to just protecting the ball the way you normally would. But I think that's going to improve for sure. But he also is not that explosive unless he can really load up in space. If he has a body on him, he's not really going up and dunking over people, kind of Dwight Howard style. Like, you know, you would see a lot of centers of the guys that we've seen in the past, Shaq, Dwight Howard, like he looks like those guys, but he doesn't have that type of bounce where he's just knocking guys back and then just like dunking over them in the post. Like he's kind of more has to get his shoulder into people, and he hasn't quite understood how to do that very well yet. And a lot of it's, as I said, is offensive rebound tips. So I think that'll improve, but it might be a little bit of a problem for him throughout his career where he's not going to make quite the percentage. The other thing too is that I think in pick and roll, I'm not sure, like we haven't seen a ton from him of like catching the ball and rumbling down the lane, or even like getting up for huge alley-oops either. Like he's not that type of explosive athlete unless he really gets up ahead of steam.
Yeah, I don't really have much to say on top of that. Have you been intrigued by the fact that Dario Saric is shooting way better from three than two?
Not really, because it's going to regress. He's at 48% on threes and 36% on twos, and that twos is a little bit concerning. Again, not a ton of space, but part of how Saric is really able to be effective in Europe with two-pointers, he's not necessarily going to drive by guys and finish at the rim, I don't think, at the NBA level, and so he's got to do a lot of his damage on post-ups. I have been really excited by just some of the quick decision making that he's able to make. His passing is outstanding, but they haven't put the ball in his hands to do a ton yet. I mean, I'd love to see like some 4 or 5 tip pick and roll type of actions with he and Embiid, or he and Okafor, give him the chance to work a little bit more as a passer, but I'm not sure that his handle in the NBA yet is quite up to that. And he's a little undersized, very short wingspan, like very bad at contesting shots out in the perimeter. So defensively, I think he could continue to struggle a little bit. And I mean, the three-point shooting is very encouraging. He shot well. He's not a pure shooter, but he started to shoot well. But, you know, I think especially once Simmons is back, I see him more as kind of a good bench guy who can facilitate a little bit as his ceiling on a good team, rather than someone who's really going to be a starter for you.
Well, and that's a huge perk of getting him on his rookie scale contract, is that they're paying him is even less than that.
All right, two more here. Let's go to the 7-2 Toronto Raptors. Your thoughts on them so far?
They've been good.
Well, actually, yeah, here, let's ask it this way. You think they're better or worse than last year?
I think they're better right now, but I'm not completely sure that the reasons that they are better are going to continue.
Why do you say that?
Because DeRozan has been insane. And
I get that. And he's shooting very well on mid-rangers. But I think that's balanced out by the fact that, and we're probably stepping on our podcast for later, but it's balanced out by the fact that no one else on this team can hit a three. Like Patterson, yeah, Carroll, Corey Joseph, DeRozan himself is shooting like 20% on threes. Lowry's only like 31%. I think the offense is going to be just as good. My biggest concern was that they would miss Biombo. Bebe is giving them something. We'll see whether that can continue, especially on the defensive glass. He's not as good there as Biombo was. I like Siakam, I think, more than they're starting for Scola last year. And I think that Siakam really can turn into a great defender in time. It'll just be a question of whether he can hit shots and provide enough offense. But he's been starting at the four for them. And he did well when he was put on to Carmelo at times. I think that they Carroll's been a little bit of a concern, just as we talked about his three-point shooting, but he also just has not had the explosion on twos. He had a rest day yesterday. He's just, maybe he'll just never be right again. I hope that he is, after that really bad knee injury that he had. It looked like it was really bad, and then he tried to play on it in the Eastern Conference Finals in 2015. He's never really been the same, it seems like.
When we mourned the loss of him right when the injury happened, and then he came back, but then we were kind of right.
Yeah, Norman Powell has been really good. They've been good with him on the floor.
Oh, can I give a Norman Powell stat?
Yeah. So, oh yeah, well no, I know you love to as a UCLA alum.
Yeah, so I was just going through one of the fun things about doing 15 and 60 is you're kind of looking at points for broad stuff and then pointing it out like if it's a surprise. And so Norman Powell has the best offensive rating of any player in the NBA with more than 10 minutes a game. That is not representative of Norman Powell's offensive impact, but it's still awesome.
One of the things I really like about this team is that their versatility against most teams, and assuming that Dwayne Casey can manage it right, they just have a lot of looks. They can go with Lowry and Joseph in the backcourt to close. They could bring in Powell. They could go with Carroll. They could go with Carroll at the four and DeRozan at the three. They could, although I like DeRozan much better at the two now, because you want him to be able to go against a wing defender who is smaller than him. Like, he's much better when he has the size advantage, because he's pretty slow laterally. So if you put a bigger guy on him, he really can struggle. He's much better just rising up over smaller players and getting them to follow him on his jumper because they're so worried about contesting. They could go with Patterson at the four. They've got Bebe maybe close the game against the Knicks last night. He was great. He was just not guarding Noah at all and came over and blocked a Rose layup. He blocked a Carmelo jumper on the left baseline. He was great defensively. I think teams that put him into positions where he has to use his intelligence a little bit more, like, we'll see whether he can handle that, but he was great last night and got some nice alley-oops too. So they can go with him. They can go with Valanciunas, although Valanciunas, it's kind of like there's no point in playing him down the end of the game, because they're never, DeRozan and Lowry are never going to throw it to him in the post. So it's like, why bother with him unless he's going to get an offensive rebound, because he's not the best defensive option.
Yeah, it's this kind of team building concept of, you want to make sure that you're putting guys in the right lane, and they have better vessels for that than Valanciunas. And so I've been intrigued. I'm intrigued by the idea of playing Siakam at the five in those kind of things, just because he's a low usage guy.
And you can switch a ton with those. That might
be enough. Two other things I wanted to mention with the Raptors that I think are a notable parts of their success. One is smaller, which is that they're leading the league in screen assists. And that was something that was a real trademark of them during that playoff run with Biombo, because he can't really do much else offensively, so he grabs offensive rebounds and sets screens, and that they've continued that this year is a very good sign. And also, they have been the second best at mitigating opposing transition opportunities, and we talked about this a little bit before, but the idea of preventing opportunities is maybe more important than being effective at it, and they're behind the Jazz, but they're ahead of everybody else, and if they can continue that, that also makes their defense that much more stout.
Yeah, the fact that we're having this debate over whether they're better last year or this year is a good sign for them. We thought that they're going to regress, and so if they look like they are still very firmly in that conversation, 2-3 in the East, I guess you're going to throw Atlanta now maybe into that tier as well until further notice. But I mean, they've done everything that you would hope that they're going to do. I think they're like sixth in SRS so far. Let's get to a team that is below sixth in SRS, the now 2-7 Washington Wizards. Marcin Gortat, after they lost against the Bulls the other day, basically said that we have one of the worst benches in the league. Do you agree with that?
Well, I mean, that bench does include Jason Smith. So Jason Smith actually has a negative PER right now. He has a negative 3.09 PER, which is pretty incredible.
And Andrew Nicholson lost his job to him anyway. I mean, I guess they're going to have to go back to Nicholson. Like, Jason Smith, I mean, has he even gotten a single rebound yet this year?
I think he has a rebound, but I don't think he has an assist. but yeah, it's the Wizards are fascinating in a lot of ways. Like, I mean, we've talked before about the disparity with and without Wall. I feel like that is a little bit understated right now in terms of the numbers, because they had, I think from what I remember, their backups had a couple of good nights, like against that kind of weird Celtics game. The backups did pretty well, but overall they just look lost without
him. Yeah, they did have to start some backups against the Bulls and they look good. Satoransky, I think, is looking better than Trey Burke now. He's probably going to move in as the backup point guard. He's got a little bit more versatility. They also actually have been starting Sheldon McClellan out of Miami, who I think spent last year in the D League. He's someone that I saw. Actually, no, he didn't spend last year in the D League, but I saw him at Adidas Nations before his senior year, and he impressed me with his effort. I'd like to watch a little bit more, but he's already supplanted Kelly Oubre. He's ahead of him in the rotation. They've been playing small a little bit more as well, just because their backup fours have been so bad. So maybe once Wall, Beal has this hamstring injury now, he's missed the last two games. Wall has been resting on the second night of back-to-backs, but this always reminds me, right, of everyone's, oh yeah, Greg Popovich, you rest. Like, why don't these other idiot coaches do that? Well, they're 2-7. That's why. And they've already lost probably two games that they would have won on back-to-backs if Wall had played. They lost by two at Orlando, and then they were right there with the Bulls last night.
That I want to talk about is, I understand from a marketing perspective that they wanted to play Wall at home against the Cavs, but that probably cost them a win.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've never really known, gotten into this that much of like, hey, if you're going to rest someone, when do you want to do it? Do you want to do it against a bad team and you might still win anyway? Or do you want to do it against a good team because you don't think you're going to win? I think that's a math problem that has like a decent answer in projections, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's a little bit easier when the first team is the Cavs because they're not going to win that game. And sure enough, they didn't. And then the second game was against the Bulls. Like, I think in that circumstance, but it does depend a lot on context and you have to figure all that kind of stuff out. I mean, there are arguments about giving yourself a better chance, but like, you can think about what the Mavericks did, where the Mavericks played all their guys against the Lakers, got that win, and then sat everybody and lost the Warriors. I mean, I think that maximized their chances over that two game stretch.
Big thing that I'm concerned with for them offensively, last in 3-point attempt rate. And it was funny, last night we were preparing for this show. We have a Google Doc that we just type in our observations in, and within maybe 30 seconds of one another, we both wrote that they are averaging only 4.6 corner threes a game, which is last in the league. And that's remarkable because John Wall is awesome at setting those up. And so I don't know if something has changed in the system, why they're not getting any of those corner three-pointers, maybe because they've been going with two bigs more. I really don't understand why, what the issue is there. And then Wall also has just been turning it over like crazy, 5.4 turnovers a game. That's always been the low-hanging fruit in his game to just do better at taking care of the ball. Just has not been able to do that as yet. And I think they're still missing Mahimi too, and he still doesn't really have any kind of a timetable, which, you know, they talked about 4 to 6 weeks, and we said why that was ridiculous. Like, nobody comes back in 4 to 6 weeks from arthroscopic surgery unless you're Pat Beverly, who apparently is about to do that. But aside from that, it's just
I want to talk about their shot distribution more. Need to. So they're last in corner three attempts, they're also last in above the break three attempts, and they're making basically none of them. They're making less than 25% from the corners, exactly 1/3 of their above the break threes. So you have those two things. So it's like you're last in both components of 3-point shooting, and they're shooting 21 mid-range shots a game, which is the most in the league. And this is, this was just ridiculous when I was going through all this minute stats. They are averaging 4 mid-range shots in the final 4 seconds of the shot clock per game.
Yeah, that's not very good either. And they're just, I don't know what it is, why they just aren't getting as many attempts. I mean, like, for example, Trey Burke, he's playing 14 minutes a game. He's not even taking 1 3-pointer. Like, he's a guy who at least has like shot the three pretty frequently in his career. Bradley Beal shooting 5 a game, but really nobody else is shooting hardly any. Satoransky, not a 3-point shooter at all. Markieff Morris, 2.3 a game is okay. He's actually hitting 40% of them. He's the only guy who's shooting well. But other than that, there's nobody in the rotation here who's above 30. 32%, and they don't have any volume either. They moved on from Whitman and they brought in Scott Brooks. Whitman went to more of a three-point happy approach last year. It didn't work. And now they've really have almost reverted back to more traditional than even they ever were under Whitman.
And it's not like, I mean, one of the big things that we hoped for with them with Scott Brooks was that they would defend better, and they haven't. You know, they haven't been better in that. So they're kind of getting the worst of both worlds. It can improve, and I think it will improve, but it could take time.
All right, I think we're done here, but I want to remind you again, watch that Twitter NBA show. As a reminder, we're doing it first on Wednesday for Raptors and Warriors, followed by Clippers and Grizzlies. We're going to come on for about a 10-minute show or so at halftime live, and then right after the game, basically within 5 minutes, we'll do a live post-game show as well. You can find that. We'll be tweeting the link out. Also, follow me on Periscope. That's where it's going to be broadcasted from, Nate Duncan NBA on Periscope. Just like Twitter, we'd love for you guys to watch that, and hopefully it's something that we'll be able to continue to do if the listenership is out there. We're asked to do it by Twitter. They're hopefully going to be promoting it, and I'm hopeful that this is going to become a thing. All right, I think we're done here.
Yeah.
Talk to you all next time.